You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Would you like to relax or fall asleep while learning about history? If so, then try my podcast, Calm History. You'll learn all about famous explorers, inventions, civilizations, ancient wonders, and even the Titanic. Just search your podcast player for Calm History or go to calmhistory.com.
In the last two episodes of the Useless Information Podcast, we followed 93-year-old Marvin Lautzenheiser from his time growing up in small-town Ohio through his days in college to his FBI field assignment in Charlotte, North Carolina, and through the work that his team did in cracking the microfilm that was hidden inside the hollow nickel that helped capture Soviet spy Rudolf Abel. Well, today in part three, Marvin will tell of his decision to leave the FBI, his 17 years consulting with the Pentagon to model theoretical future nuclear wars, his patents that are still in use on computer storage devices today, plus, you'll get to hear music being played on his monster-sized theater organ that he installed in his home. All that and more is coming up next in the final installment of The Cryptanalyst. I am Steve Silverman, and this is the Useless Information Podcast.
Useless information.
Welcome back. As I mentioned, this is the third and final segment of my interview with Marvin. And in this first section, Marvin will talk a little bit more about his boss, Downing. Then he'll comment a bit more on the nickel case. And then he's going to go on to discuss a different case. That's the Brown-Green case that he was assigned to deal with. Now, the interesting thing about that one is that he should have never gotten it. As you'll hear, it was just a little slip of the tongue by then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that made him have to deal with this. Now, this is not a significantly important case, but I included it just to give you a little bit of an insight into the power that Hoover wielded while he was in charge of the Bureau. So let's listen in. And what was Downing's first name, do you remember?
Yes, Churchill.
That's an unusual one.
Yes, Churchill Downing. He had been divorced. His only life was the Bureau, and it didn't matter that you had families. You were supposed to be like Hoover. Hoover was not married, and he thought your life should be only devoted to the FBI. Churchill Downing tried to emulate him, but overdid it even. In fact, in the Brown case, as you have already read, I think.
Well, I've read it, but of course, people who'll be listening have no clue about it. So why don't you just start from the beginning on how that came about, right? It had to do with going into Hoover, not you going into Hoover's office, but Downing doing that, right?
Yes. The going into my Hoover office was totally related to the taking tours. Once I became an agent, I would never go to his office again unless there was some special thing, which I think only happened once or twice. But anyway, Downing was on his own on this. When I came back as an agent, his attitude towards me changed. He'd been pretty good to me, difficult, but pretty good to me while I was doing the cryptanalysis studies and up through the time I got to the Agents Academy. I didn't have a lot to do with him. I dealt with Newfer most of the time. Woody Newfer was the old agent that I worked for through my classes, my studies, and so on. He had a fantastic history. He had been in Spain during World War II, and he broke into the German embassy there, copied their code books, printed them on their printer, and left them placed with a printout of their code book. He had nerves of steel, and one of the nicest persons in the world. His family and my family got to be close friends, and even through all my trouble with Downing, we still remain close friends. But anyway, I didn't have a lot of close contact with Downing until I was an agent. And then I worked directly for him. And the Nickel case came maybe within the first week or two. Older agents had already worked on that at the time it was given to me. But they never told me their deductions. I didn't realize enough to just go say, why didn't you tell me this? But I started at the beginning, all my tests. But now I could run them on the computer, which they didn't have before. When I got there, it was right after the computer was installed. So they didn't have any help like that. It was all by hand. So we thought maybe with the help of the computer, I might do something. And I did everything over again that they had done by hand and everything I could dream of. Oh, I would think at night, I'd go to bed thinking, what did I not do yet on this thing? I was so determined I was going to break it. But of course, everything that was given to me, I was determined I'm going to break this. Sometimes you did and sometimes you didn't, but that was my attitude about it.
So let's talk about the Brown-Green case. Just try and describe what happened, how Downing got involved, and then basically set you up and what you did about it.
Well, I don't know how Downing got it, because he shouldn't have. It was an investigative problem. We have a bureau, investigative section, and they were the ones that administered all the fields. They covered all the fields, offices, and how they did things and everything. And here comes along something that was definitely one of their problems. And here I am several degrees away in a cryptanalysis section being given this to come up and make up for Hoover's just slip of tongue. It was nothing more than that.
So what did Hoover do? Why don't you explain that?
He just, at the end of their weekly meetings on a Friday, he had a staff meeting with the assistant directors every Friday morning. And this Friday, he was leaving to go out, I think, to some of the field offices over the weekend or maybe just vacation. But anyway, he wanted to get away early. So they finished everything else, and they were all holding their breath about this because it was national headlines. And he said, what's going on with the Green case? And they were all stunned because they expected him to say, what's going on with the Brown case? Of all the people in the world, they were the closest to him, assistant directors, and they would not say, don't you mean the Brown case?
And what exactly was going on in the Brown case that they were concerned about it?
Well, within the last week or two or three of the time of this happened, there was a fugitive named Brown. I don't know if he was on the Odessa 10 Most Wanted, but he was way up on the need to catch. And so he was very upset. You do not arrest the wrong person. You just don't do that. The FBI always gets them right.
So in other words, they arrested the wrong Brown.
They arrested the wrong person. It wasn't even Brown. Well, yes, it was Brown, but it wasn't the same first name. It was the same model of car, except it was a two-door instead of a four-door. But it was the same color, same year, everything. And his driver's license didn't match. So they should have known. But, you know, there was so much that it was in favor of him being the right guy. They figured he should have changed his driver's license or something. But anyway, they arrested him. And then it came out that, of course, he was not the right person. And it hit the newspapers, the FBI arrested the wrong person in some kind of, I guess he was already famous or something. But some of that's guesswork. I don't know why he was so important. But he was. And they arrested the wrong guy. And Hoover was very much upset about it. And so they were waiting for his wrath when that meeting was getting down to the end. And to their surprise, he says, what's happening in the Green case? None of the assistant directors would say, don't you mean Brown? Don't you think one of them should have been brave enough to say, don't you mean that? Well, anyway, because of that, the investigative people said they were in deep trouble already. They didn't want to go any deeper. And so I guess they... I have to guess from how it got to Downing, but Downing, I think, volunteered that he would take care of it. And, of course, the investigations were so happy to get it off their hands because they knew whatever was written was going to be wrong. He would wonder, what are you putting this stuff on my desk for? But anyway, I got off. I worried the whole weekend. Well, the whole weekend I was working, I worried through the night. got into work, and I just was waiting for the hammer to come down. What happened? Why did he do this? And I got off the hook because he just looked at the name on the thing. He said, oh, I meant Brown Case, and didn't read all my gobbledygook.
So basically, this is on a Friday, and you were given till Monday to find out whatever you could on Green?
Yep, till Monday morning at 9, I had to have it on Downing's desk. Well, it was supposed to be on Hoover's desk, I think, by 9. And I'm not sure about whether it was Downing's or his. But anyway, I had till Monday morning to have this on the desk. I arranged with Downing's secretary that she would come in late Sunday for typing whatever I had to go. And I got volunteers from some of the other stenos to come in and read the Green Case files. And my team volunteered to come. Each one of them volunteered for at least some time. And so I had a lot of people there, 8 or 10 people working off and on through Saturday and Sunday. I stayed until late Friday night. I came in early Saturday morning, stayed late that night, came in Sunday morning. And finally, about mid-afternoon, I decided, well, this is the best I have. It's not much.
So basically, you had to find all the Green cases that were out there for the FBI and choose the best one.
Yes, I called the files and I had them send up all the Green cases that could be of interest currently throughout the whole country. And they came in, they had these charts, you know, that hauled files. And they came in chart load after chart load of these things, and they all had to be reviewed. And none of them were interesting. I really just had to pick the least bad. And I wrote up a single-page memo for Mr. Hoover. Anyway, that's what happened.
And in the end, it didn't make any difference. You did your job. And it went to his desk, and he said, I meant the Brown case, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. If any of his assistant directors had said, don't you mean Brown, it would have been all over right then.
Next, Marvin discusses why he decided to leave the FBI. As you'll hear, his boss Downing did not treat him very well. You see, Downing was unrealistic in his expectations, and that included requiring Marvin to document that all computer equipment, which was crazy expensive back then, all computer equipment had to be in use 100% of the time. I mean, think about that. Is your computer, printer, or scanner in use all the time? Of course not. Yet Marvin had no choice but to fudge the machine usage logs and timesheets just to appease his boss Downing.
I come to the conclusion that there was no way up for me and there was no way to stay.
And why is that?
Well, because Downing was not going to let me work. He was going to just keep bothering me. For the whole year up until the NASA stuff, I had not had any problems with Downing with regard to my workers. Suddenly after, within a week or two after that, suddenly Dean Ernest's desk, the desk drawer, the bottom left one, had a little dust in it and did not have a dust rag with a slight dusting on it. And please speak to Mr. Ernest about this and make sure it doesn't happen again. So I had to write a memo saying that I had spoken to Ernest and I had done this and I had told him about how important it was to follow the FBI rules. And anyway, I had to demean myself into saying how bad I was because of that dust. Then about 6 weeks later, it would be Lauren Gills. He was the other crypt person that worked with me. And it was a different desk drawer. It was something, the same thing. One time there was a paper left. It was just a paper with nothing on it of significance, but you're not allowed to leave any papers in your desk. The only thing you could have in your desk was a tickler. Of course, you should not put anything of secrecy in there. But you had a tickler every day. If one day with a tickler for so-and-so, one or the other has not been pulled for that day when they...
What is a tickler?
You have a set of hanging files. I don't know, hanging or not hanging, but there's 31 slots in it, 31 places for things to be, papers to be put in.
Okay.
It's marked 1, 2, 3 through 31. If today is the 7th of something, immediately when you come in to work, you pull all the papers out of the 7 and you take care of what you can, and the ones you can't, you mark them for the 8 or for the 9 and you put them in a future folder. it was the rule that you should not leave work with anything in today's folder. No matter how trivial, it shouldn't be important because it would have been locked up in the safe if it had been. But anyway, that's the way it was. And so one time it was that tickler who hadn't been pulled for the day. It was something about what the programming was. It was nothing important, but he hadn't pulled his tickler. So I had to write a memo about how I'd talked to so-and-so. I don't know if it was Ernest or Gil. Anyway, that's the kind of thing he was doing. He picked on me on personal things about my shirt was out of style. My way of putting on my jacket in the evening was so awkward. How could I be so awkward? I didn't get through a week without some new thing about him.
And these are all tiny little things, right?
Yeah, they're just little irksome things. But he had made it clear that I was not going to go anywhere. And I didn't want to go anywhere. I wanted to do what I was doing. But it was just I was going to get a transfer. I knew whenever the stuff about the machine usage came to light and the timesheets came to light, those were two things that were no-nos. And I knew when those come to light, I would be transferred. I had little kids in school. I didn't want to go to a place like New York or Chicago or someplace. Incidentally, I stepped forward and out of the Bureau for about a year, and one of my friends there told me and said, "Do you know what happened?" I said, "No." He said, "The inspectors came in, and the guy that took over for me is now in Chicago on the field. He's no longer a supervisor." So I felt that that was coming for me, that sooner or later there'd be a snap inspection, and I'd be criticized severely for that, and I'd be out in the field. I didn't mind going to the field, but I didn't want to go to Chicago or something. I'd have been happy to go back to Charlotte.
Next, Marvin discusses leaving the FBI and going to work for a company named TechOps, which is short for Technical Operations. They were designing a program to simulate various nuclear war situations, which was an incredibly complex thing to do back in the late 1950s. Now, as you listen to this section, once again envision how primitive computers were at this time. It's hard to believe, but the new IBM 709 that this program was being designed for, it was built using vacuum tubes, not transistors or chips, and Marvin had to learn how to operate it without having any access to the machine itself.
I left in December of 58, but I had leave that took me over into January. So I always say I left at the end of December. And I went to a place called TechOps. I'd never heard of them. They're a company in Massachusetts, close to Boston, where they had a specialty. They had a machine that went down in wells and to check the welds where the sections were welded together. They could photograph them in some sense and see if there were any weaknesses, any bubbles or anything in the welds, so it should be fixed before they had pressure on it. And somehow they had weaseled a contract for a lot of money to set up an office in Washington to do an operation on the computer to simulate the war, the nuclear war. And it had been thought up by Rand Corporation. You must have heard of them.
Sure.
They had thought it up, but they didn't want to build it. They gave that over to this division that was set up in Washington. And I was not thrilled, actually, by going to that. That didn't sound like very interesting to me. Turns out it was more interesting than I could imagine. But anyway, I went there as a programmer, and I got a good raise. And I went in, they had about 30 people there. Most of them not too much older than I was on their teams. Anyway, I got there and I was given a desk. There were several people with dividers, and I was getting a program and some flowcharts. I guess I hadn't reached programs yet quite, but there were flowcharts, and I was to check those to see if they would work. Anyway, they gave me what somebody else had written up as the flowcharts that would be programmed to do this, and it didn't make any sense to me at all. But I kept studying them, and I found out they had built a special operating system. You know, we didn't have decent operating systems then. We were working on the 709, which actually didn't exist yet for us. The Air Force hadn't gotten theirs installed yet. but we were going to work on a 709, and we were to build this simulation of strategic nuclear warfare, as you just wouldn't obliterate everything. And so I was reading through this of what somebody else had said would do the job. Well, first, the fact that they had their proprietary operating system meant that nothing else ever existed to tell you about it. And they had built it specially to do this job, and they had built it on the basis of running with tables for the data. We had tables for the fuel usage, and that meant at a certain altitude and a certain speed, you're using so much, and you can go so far on this many gallons of fuel. There would be another one for the radiation, what happened on the ground when the nuclear bomb went off. You had distances of damage, and especially the damage to the airfield, because if the airfield got hit, obviously the bomber couldn't take off, and so on. And each of these was given to a different so-called team. So the team I was on was a team of two, me and the man who had written the flowchart. So I studied through these, and I finally was starting to get the feeling of how this new operating system worked. I finally had just about mastered that, and the boss called me, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm not doing very well. And he says, Rosenheiser, I think you're the only one in the whole bunch here that knows what's going on. And he says, I want you to take on some more here, and I want you to just get on with the bombers as fast as you can. So I was working on, and I finally got to where I could actually code. Turns out the fellow who wrote the flowchart had no idea how coding was done. he just had no idea, but his logic was pretty good. So we got in the same room, finally, just got a room to ourselves, and so we could discuss things real nicely. And after a week or two or three, I said, John, do you mind if I redo some of your logic here to make it fit the program and so on? He says, sure, go ahead. So we would discuss the changes. So anyway, about 2 or 3 months after I was there, one Friday they came in and handed me a book. It was a 709 operating system book. And they said, here, they got the new machine in at the Air Force in the Pentagon. Monday morning, you go over there and go down to that computer and you run it. They don't have anybody in the Air Force who can run the 709. I said, but wait a minute. They said, you've run the 650. I said, yeah, but it was a biquinary machine, and this is a pure binary machine. And besides, this has tape drives. We never had tape. They said, you're the most qualified here, and they told us we should use that machine if we can run it. You just go over there Monday morning. So I studied the machine at the book all day, all weekend, and I went over there Monday morning until I knew what I was doing. And here was about 5 Air Force men milling around. What do we do? What do we do next? I had taken the operating system cards with me, and I said, here, put those in the card reader. And I went to the console, and you know, sure enough, I got the console to start up, and I read the cards. And the operating system was up, waiting for programs. So I spent the first 2 weeks, I ran their machine for them, and they finally got somebody qualified. I guess he was at school during that time. And I went in and they said, no, you don't run the machine anymore. We run it. So, and actually, I could go to that machine any for about a year, maybe 2 years. I still went in, and when I got there, they'd let me run the machine. I got there one day, and they said, you aren't qualified to see the machine. So they had decided it was too classified for me. And so I didn't go, but I knew the operator because I'd been working with them. And so I would take my stuff over and my cards, and I'd ask one of the operators to run it for me, and he'd say tell me when he could get it in. Maybe it was right away, maybe it was in a couple of hours. A lot of times he said, well, you can't get in till tomorrow. He says, but how big is your job? And I'd tell him, and he says, I'll get it in for you, just wait. And he'd bring my jobs in and run them. I was on very good terms with him.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerd will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The new IBM 709 computer only had 32 kilobytes of word memory. That meant that at any one time, it could only store 32,768 words, each of those words consisting of six alphanumeric characters in its memory. And with the operating system taking up half of that memory, that really didn't leave much space for the program itself. And due to all these limited resources, the computers are incredibly slow also. Let's jump into our conversation where Marvin explains how long it took to run a single war simulation. And along the way, Marvin will tell you about his invention of paging. That's the way the modern computers store and retrieve data from hard drives today.
Anyway, we finally got the thing built, and it ran. It took 80 hours for one replication of the World at War. Well, after that model was running, the Air Force came back and said, we want you to build a model that will run in 40 hours. We can live with that, but we can't live with 80 hours. So they said, we want you to build a halftime model, and we want Lotzenheiser to be in charge. They didn't like the one that was in charge at the time. And so they came to me and they said, we have an option. You take the job, or we'll have to go on the street and convince the Air Force that we can bring on somebody who's expert. So I said, I'll tell you tomorrow. And I come home and I thought, I don't want to work for somebody else. It's been bad enough with the one that's there. So somebody come in cold, I'll have to teach them. And by this time, I was really handling just about all the different parts. The team was still there, but I was the one that fixed everything. So I said, okay. And so suddenly I had about 30 people working for me. And I was given the job of building this model that would run in half time. So I went down through the whole thing from beginning, what Rand had suggested, and figured out a way that I thought would work. And so I redid it from scratch. I didn't follow any of the old stuff. The old stuff had a tape with the operating system on it, and a tape with the data on it, and a tape with the programs on it. And it just was cumbersome. And every part of the program was hinged on the next one, which was hinged on the next one. You got to the last one, it came back to the first one. Every 15 minutes, you put out a report of what the situation was, how many bombers had gotten off, how many fighters had gotten off, and so on. The idea was that they could cycle this thing around and everything was set up for another 15 minutes. I set up a different way of doing it. I called it a task list drive. So each one that needed at least something to be done by another section just called that one up. And I was so far ahead of myself, I never realized it until many years later. I had built paging, which didn't come in until we had disks. We weren't even close to disks in the 1950s, 1960s. So anyway, I didn't know what I had.
So the program originally took 80 hours. They wanted it reduced to 40. In the end, how fast did you get it?
3 hours.
3 hours. So you took it from 80 down to 3 hours.
Yeah. And of course, they were very happy with me.
And you also mentioned to me when we spoke a few weeks ago that it changed two things in their war plans.
Well, there were two things that made the public knowledge. I don't know how many more things changed. But I think you must remember that we had rocket sites around our cities to defend us. And that turned out to be a mistake. The rocket sites were defending the military stuff. Every military base had rockets around it. But it was a mistake because the nuclear targeting wasn't very accurate. But it didn't matter. It was so big it would get things anyway. But because of that, they would target a military base, like we have a base near Washington, but they'd miss it and hit the population. And so if they took away these sites that were defending the base, defending the cities, they wouldn't target them anymore. The headline always says 100, this came out quite a while later, 100 million lives. And that was the number of people more who would die within the first day if they kept the sites here or if they took them out. Just took them out, didn't replace it with anything.
And this is the result of the program you ran?
Yes, as a result of the program. They kept coming back saying how much was done, and finally it dawned on them to take out the defensive sites, and the program popped up with 100 million difference.
Wow.
They did a lot of different studies, but of course I didn't see the real data. I saw sanitized data, so I don't know. But I knew at the time about this because I did I saw the printouts of my stuff, and I could see what the trend was. Anyway, that was one thing that was a change. The other one that made the publicity was that they used to have the bombers take off, say, at Washington, and they'd meet a tanker taking off from New York, which would meet one in Greenland somewhere, so they could refuel the bombers on the way, and then they were on their own for that last leg. And the program came back and said, every one of your bombers went down in the ocean. We had a program called Splash that put them down, so it gave the location they went down.
And what was the reason that the bombers weren't making their target?
Because no tankers got out off base. The bases had been hit first, and so the tanker base would be closer to Russia, and so they would be hit early. And the bombers got out there, and nobody was there to meet them. And this happened with every bomber. It wasn't just a few. Every bomber failed. And the military was just up in the air. My program must be wrong. And so because we could run it in 3 hours, I said, just change your random number and do it again. And again, all the bombers went down. So anyway, that was one of the things that came up. They changed the way they now have the buddy system. Instead of waiting for one tanker to meet you, they take off with two or three tankers with them. So you waste maybe half a dozen tankers to get the bomber to its target, and that multiplies by every bomber you want to send.
Marvin stayed at TechOps for about 3 years. Then the group that built the operating system for TechOps, they split off and asked Marvin to join their new company, and he agreed to do so. His assignment was to build a complete operating system for Bell Telephone, which he completed all by himself in less than a year. Then he received a phone call from an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who he knew very well, and he explained that they'd been unable to get a tactical nuclear program to work. Marvin picks up the story there.
And he explained that they had called in experts from Michigan, some university in Michigan and Princeton, and both had declared that this program could not work. It wouldn't work in the size of the machine for the size of the program. As he said, this is all QT. I'm not allowed to do this. He says, but I'll give you a copy of the listing, and you look at it and see if you can fix it. And if you can, we got $50,000 for you to set up a small company who can get you the clearance you have to have, and we'll get you a contract. Well, first hour or two I looked at it, I saw they had done the most stupid thing in the world. Have you ever heard of thrashing in a computer?
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
It means that the program keeps starting to do something, it gets interrupted and goes back to do something else, but then it gets interrupted to do something else, and it never gets done with the interruptions, and it finally just conks out. Well, that's about what was happening here. They had it thrashing. I don't know why the people from the so-called experts wouldn't have realized this. It took me about a week to fix it and test it.
And so at this point, since you were successful at this, you went off and founded your own company. Is that correct?
Well, they asked me to. And Chauncey Seafelt from the FBI, coincidentally, had run into things there, and he did not want to stay there. So he came out at the same time that they were asking me. He says, why don't we set up a company? And coincidentally, it was right at the time they were saying, why don't you set up a company? So we did, a two-man company. Actually, we got a secretary, so it made three people. We rented a small space in an office near where I live in Springfield. And we were off and running, not very well. We were limping because this $50,000 didn't go very far. Even then, it was a lot of money. But when you have office rents and so on, it was going to run us maybe a year. And his job, Chauncey's job, was to go out and find other work, which he couldn't. After that went out, we got a new contract for doing some more work for them, and then another one. Each year we got a new contract, just scarcely enough to keep us running.
Well, after 3 or 4 years, another company came along and offered to buy Marvin and Chauncey out, and they agreed. Now, they still did what they wanted to do, but now new work was being sent their way. And in the meantime, the Joint Chiefs of Staff took over the modeling stuff from the Air Force.
When the Joint Chiefs of Staff took over, then I had to go to meet them, and we'd have 20 or so generals and bird colonels in the room, all of them asking me questions at the same time. Can you do this? How do you do that? Why does this work? And those, by definition, aren't necessarily very polite people. I just say that as an observation. They wanted quick answers, but they wouldn't let me answer until somebody else brought it in. So this went on until 1970s. Eventually, I dropped the military, and maybe they dropped me. It was mutual anyway. I had run through my time.
Marvin may no longer been working with the Pentagon to design programs to evaluate war plans, but he still had plenty of work to do. His focus turned to smaller contracts that the company who bought him out was sending his way. And these were all service bureau type jobs, basically data processing services. So let's listen in.
And the service bureau portion was specializing in labels for charities and nonprofits. Anybody who needed a lot of mailing labels would come to them with a mailing list. They'd punch it up and run it through their program. But their program was less than decent. It was awful. So I wrote a new program for doing the labels. In the process of doing that, I discovered that this is not the way to do it. I'll build a program that keeps you from building programs. Because we had not only make labels, they wanted reports from this, how many people in this district or this zip code and so on. And then you had to print out a report. Well, there was a special program for each of those reports. Oh, and we had files coming in that weren't in the system that we used, so I had to build programs to convert that data into our files. I had to look at the layout of the data, figure out how to take that and put it into our layout. Anyway, I always did it, but it was tiresome. So I started out by building a converter that you could tell it the old file layout and the new file layout, and it would automatically just take the data through and do it.
Not only did Marvin build a converter to import all of the data, he also did the same thing with the reports and the mailing labels. And what would take other companies a week to do, he could do the same in 20 or 30 minutes. And this gave his company a big leg up when the 1980 presidential elections came about.
Okay, well, anyway, the Democratic Party came to us first. No, they split off from it, and I can't remember his name. He was a nice person. And they brought their stuff to us, and I gave them back within a couple of days the reports, and they were so thrilled that they called the Democratic Party leaders and told them to bring their stuff to us. So I was doing all the financing reports for those two campaigns. They were so thrilled because they had gone to a big company who gave them an estimate. It would take them 3 weeks or 6 weeks or some long time, and it would cost you $10,000. After this was all over, of course, the campaign was over. That was the end of that. But we still had a lot of other people who were using us. Chauncey and I were at work one day on a Saturday. Nobody else was there, and a man walked into our office, and we were confused. Why would somebody come in our office on Saturday? And he said, I'm with such and such a company, and we wanted to see who took that contract away from us. He said, we just couldn't believe that anybody could underbid us. We bid low already. It was only $10,000 in 3 or 4 or 6 weeks. I don't know the number. He said, we just had to see who took it away from us. And we told him we were the ones, and he couldn't believe that this little company could do it. And he said, but how could you possibly program? I said, we didn't program. We have a system. that we built. It was called the AccuFile system, incidentally, the whole combination. And we have this AccuFile system that we have built, and they'll say, we just take your data descriptions and what report descriptions, and we're done. They just don't believe us.
And in the final chapter of Marvin's career, the company he'd been working for was absorbed by the Zytel Corporation, and they had an office in Tysons Corner, Virginia. The company specialized in solid-state memory, which they built out in California. Now, the starting price was about $15,000 to $16,000 for their memory, and it went way up into the half-million-dollar range. And at that price, they weren't selling much, at least until Marvin rescued them.
They weren't selling very many. In fact, they closed the office here. I started working here on this stuff. They closed that office and asked me to go to California. They said, you have a job in California. And I said, okay, I'll be there. They didn't expect me, but I got out there and I worked on this. I built a simulator to simulate the operations on a given computer. They could run a trace and know what happened, but they couldn't fix it. So I would take the traces and run it through my simulator, and it would tell me what was wrong. It would tell me exactly how much memory, solid-state memory, would do the most good for them. They were trying to oversell. They were selling twice or three times as much or four times as needed for a given place. But I looked at the trace from that same place, and I'd draw a graph, and it would go out and be a big place where a big drop-off started. It would be, and it would suddenly drop off. Any more you put on doesn't help anything. They were able to sell 8 megabytes or 16 instead of 64, and they started selling 2 or 3 a week. I was so popular with our marketing group that come the Christmas party, which was financed by all these sales, they had marketing people all come in, and they gave out awards. And they had given out awards for most sales and awards for other things, and they got down, there was one left. And they said, and this goes to Lautenheiser for his method of telling how much was needed to be sold. And the marketing group all jumped up and started yelling. So they appreciated it. I'd saved the company. Beast.
Another problem Marvin had to deal with was the slowness of accessing data from disks. He was able to cut the time that the CPU, that's the brain of the computer, the time the CPU sat around waiting for data, he cut it from 30 to 50 milliseconds down to 50 microseconds at a time. And for his work, he was awarded 5 U.S. patents. Amazingly, his creation is still in use today. It's used in your computer right now. And as you're about to hear, Zytel sat on the idea for 2 years.
So they were getting responses in 50 milliseconds. So I would be sending back data within 50 microseconds. I showed them how, and they said, oh, it'll eat our lunch. Of course it will, because somebody else is going to eat it if you don't. Tech stuff goes fast. But anyway, 2 years later, they realized what they'd done, and they built it, and it was just a wonderful thing for them. They got a contract from IBM for royalty on my patents. They were paying $2 to $3 million a month to Zytel. So anyway, I got my patents, and eventually I figured out I'm 65. They brought in a bunch of younger people who knew how to do everything, and I was 65. It was time for me to go, so I retired. But they didn't let me retire. I came back here, and I worked. I got another patent just on the stuff I worked on when I came back, except they didn't pay the final fee. They went broke. So that was when the IBM money ran out, and they'd spend up all the surplus they'd built up. And it's because they did not test their stuff. The programmers just refused to test. I used to say 5% of your time is writing, and 95% is everything else it takes. Writing code is 5%. That's the dessert on the meal.
And now we're going to totally change the topic from work to play. You see, Marvin once owned a giant theater organ. It was so large that he had to build an extension onto his house, and it was nearly identical in size to the original house itself. So this is a massive theater organ. It came out of a real theater, right?
Oh, yes. It came out of a 30, 500-seat theater.
And where was it located?
It was in New York City. Actually in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
Triborough Theater was the name of it, T-R-I-B-O-R-O-U-G-H.
Mm-hmm.
They had built a Triborough Bridge, and Lowe's thought that because of that bridge, people would flock out to this new theater, which was right near the end of the bridge.
Sure.
The people never came, so the theater didn't do well. By the time I got this organ, there was a contact I had in New York City who was deep into finding organs in theaters that were going to be destroyed or weren't used, and he found this one for me. He got quite a fee for his finders, but I didn't care. I paid him $3,700, and I don't know what he gave the theaters. He may have gotten it for free, for all I know.
And what year was this?
It was 62, I think.
Okay.
Yes, it was 62. My nephew and I went up. We made 8 trips to New York City.
Wow.
He had a pickup truck and a trailer that we used to go up. And the trailer was full every time except once. We didn't take it. When we got to Chonsol, we only took the truck itself. The union in New York is pretty strong. I could not move the Chonsol out of the theater. I was able to take the pipes out and all the mechanism, but when I changed to take the Chonsol out, the Chonsol and the orchestra had been on elevators, separate elevators, and they had run those down some years ago and put in steel beams over top of them and put floors in so it could crowd in a few more seats that were going to be empty anyway. So anyway, I had to go down in the basement of the theater, crawl through a little door, and there sat the Chonsol on its elevator. They had piled junk on top of it. So I took all the junk out that was there, and the labor union came in with a crew to chop out the floor ahead above it. And we could bring the elevator up, and they took it out. There were 6 of them came, and they took it up the aisle and out to their truck and put it on the truck for us for a fee. Anyway, the organ had 2 chambers, one on each side of the front for the pipes. One would be way up on the left side and the other way up on the right side. And they had shutters in front of them that rotated to let the sound out softer or louder. So anyway, after I had bought the thing, I had 6 weeks to get out of the theater. We had pipes all through the house in the basement. I had dug a basement under the house, and I just finished that basement, and I bought the pipe organ. So I set them up down there. The shorter pipe could set up in the chest. So I set that up down, and the bigger pipes had to go everywhere else. The garage was full, except the one end of the garage is where we put the console. There was no building for it at this point.
So let me ask you a question. So how did you get an interest in this?
Oh, I was always interested. Now, I got in the Theater Organ Society in 1958. I guess I should go clear back to when I was a kid. When I was about 8 years old, 9, my brother lived in Canton, Ohio, and I went to visit him and stayed for a week, and he took me to this big theater in Canton, Ohio. And the movie was interesting. It was a Joey Brown movie. It was a comedy. But the main thing to me is they played this wonderful music in between shows. They had about 15 minutes of this music. And that was the most important thing to me. And I always dreamed of playing one or having one. And lo and behold, eventually it happened. That was my interest in it. And Dad always talked about how these were not really organs. They were an orchestra. And that was right because you had all the different pipes of an orchestra. This is not to be confused with a church organ. They're very different. This is a theater organ. They play oboes and tubas, flutes, a lot of the orchestra instruments. And, of course, we had the marimba and the xylophone and the bells, the chimes, drums, snare drum, bass drum, just everything you could think of for an orchestra. And it was to play, of course, that was the purpose, was to play along with the string, and the organist would watch the string and play appropriate things. If there was a horse running, he had horse hoofs that would gallop. And everything was happening. If the doorbell was being rung, he could ring the doorbell. if a char was honking the horn, he had an old Ooga horn that would play. So he was in command of the sound effects for the movie. So I got all that stuff, but here I am with a house full of all this stuff and no place for it to be built. But I already planned the building. I knew it. I should build a building the same size as the house on the opposite side of the garage.
And that's exactly what Marvin did. Well, I'm not going to reveal his street address. I did check out his house on Google Maps in Street View mode, of course, and one would be hard-pressed to determine which half of the building was his house and which half of the building housed the theater organ. Marvin and his nephew built the building themselves, and that included cutting and pre-drilling all the rafters and pieces in his basement. And of course, with Marvin being a mathematician, it should come as no surprise that the assembly went smoothly and everything fit together perfectly. The new building measured 42 by 28 feet, which is 12.8 by 8.5 meters. It would take them 2 years to complete the project, but the theater organ, when it was done, had one significant limitation, and that is a human being is limited to just 10 fingers. So no one person could play every part of an orchestral piece. But Marvin had a perfect solution for this. He would install a computer. Now keep in mind, this is the early 1970s. Of course, this is simpler said than done. You can't just install a computer. Marvin needed to install the wiring, the circuit boards, relays, electromagnets, and so on. And they needed to control each and every pipe in that giant theater organ. The theater organ took up half of the building. And while far too detailed for this podcast, Marvin did explain to me how it all worked and how he could operate 40 different things at one time. He did send me a CD of a record he recorded with his first wife, Jean, back in 1974. It is titled Two Loves Have I, Jean and the Genie Computer. And I'll play Marvin's favorite song at the end of the podcast. But just for comparison, let's hear a sample of Jean, his first wife, playing, and then I'll follow it with a song played by the computer. So first up, we have A Man Without Love, and of course, this is played by his ex-wife, Jean. And next up, we have a sampling of 76 trombones, which is played by Genie the computer.
Would you like to relax or fall asleep while learning about pivotal moments in history? If so, then try my new podcast, Calm History. It's a time machine of tranquility, filled with immersive and fascinating stories from history. Prior episodes include The Pilgrims, Marco Polo, Henry Ford, Joan of Arc, Jackie Robinson, Klondike Gold Rush, Ancient Greek Olympics, Easter Island, and the Great Pyramid of Giza. There's also a 6-part series about the Titanic. Just search your podcast player for Calm History or go to calmhistory.com.
Now, a computerized theater organ was unheard of back then, so the American Theater Organ Society asked Marvin to write an article about it. Simply titled Genie, the article appeared in the October 1972 publication of their journal Theater Organ. So I asked Marvin if anyone had ever computerized a theater organ prior to him doing so.
No, I don't think there was anybody else.
So you were the first.
I had no proof of that, but nobody else did it. To my knowledge. In fact, I never came up with anybody since who has done exact, but I haven't kept up with it. The last 10 years or so, I haven't paid much attention to the Theater Organ Society. I'm still a member, but it's just to support them.
So what happened to the organ? Why don't you explain that?
Well, now you come to one of my biggest disappointments in the world. when we had this organ here, we had kids coming and playing it, and grown-ups coming and playing it. Later on, they were in a group in Baltimore called the Free State Theater Organ Society, and they had an agreement with an auditorium where they had a workshop and the use of the auditorium for programs, and they were allowed to install an organ there. They had a makeshift organ there, and they came to me in 2009, October. October. And they said, we'd like to put your organ in this auditorium. Well, these are the people I had known from the times they were kids. And I thought, well, I can't take care of it much longer. And it's friends. It'll be in a nice auditorium. I'd heard the makeshift organ there. It was okay, but it wasn't really much of an organ. So they came up with an agreement that they would move it. Had to be set up within 2 years so I could play it. At the time, I thought my days are getting numbered. And they said we'll have it set up in a year. Well, after I signed the thing and gave it to them, a year went by. They hadn't even moved it out yet. 2 years went by. They hadn't moved it out yet. They were busy figuring out the chambers, and they just didn't do what they were what they said they would. But all the time they were moving it, they kept saying, we'll have this played in a year or two. So time went on, and eventually it just sits up there in pieces. They threw away the relays, which was a wonderful item of interest, but they threw them away. They were going to put in all solid-state stuff. They cut up the console into pieces, and they had promised they would take it out in one piece. But instead, they cut all the cables off with a hacksaw and had it taken out in little pieces. Keyboards were separate. The pedals were separate. Everything was gone. I couldn't have even reassembled it. So I haven't spoken to them in years, but the organ was destroyed. I still have the computer, but of course it's meaningless. There's nothing hooked onto it, but I kept it. So I still have it sitting out here in the room, which has turned into a work room and storage room and nothing. So anyway, that's the story of the organ, and it's one of my grievous things in my life that I regret every time I think about it.
It is very sad. I mean, to make that promise and then do nothing. Do you think they lost interest, or do you think it was a money problem or a time problem?
It was a combination of things. One is they were getting on in years, and by the time they actually got around to this, some of the men that were working on it were my age. They were not in any better shape to do it than I was, but they had some people in their 40s and 50s, and I just fell for their story. I think they believed their story, but it just didn't happen.
Yeah, they may have had good intentions, but they really didn't have the mechanism to see it through, you know?
That's what happened. I should have advertised the organ with computer and seen if I could get somebody to take it. I would have taken any price as long as they were good. I actually gave it to this group, but I wanted somebody I could depend on. I thought, who can I trust better than these people that I've known all their lives? So that was one of the saddest things I've ever done in my life.
Now, my original intention was to end the interview after discussing the theater organ, but honestly, I didn't want to end it on a down note. And we did talk for a bit after this, and I questioned Marvin as to how he met his second wife, Paula. And it's definitely far more upbeat than the loss of his beloved theater organ, and I figured that's a good place to bring his life story to a close. So let's listen to that. Now, how did the two of you meet?
Well, after I got out of the FBI, I still had friends in the FBI, some pretty close. And one of them said, I have somebody, after my wife moved out and the divorce was finished, he said, I have somebody I want you to meet. And so he got tickets for a musical here in Washington. And he said, I'll make a date. She comes with you and we'll go out to the musical and we'll double date. I said, okay, because I knew at this time, or I thought at this time, I was moving to California. So I told him, I don't want to get serious with anybody. I'm moving away. And he said, well, come on anyway. I want you to meet her. So we met, and we hit it off pretty well. She had been divorced, and I had a bad divorce. And so we went out, we had our little meal, and went to the show. And so, I still had a month, I thought, before I moved. And so we dated. I'd dated somebody else, but it wasn't serious either. And I knew when I moved out, it was the end of that. So, I'll meet her too. And so I went to meet her. We went out and had some dinners and whatever, get-togethers. And I got kind of serious, but I told her I was moving, and I had to stop then. I'd be gone. Well, she called me out in California, and it became a ritual of, if not every night, every other night she called. And we sort of grew together by the phone. I went out in 1987, and she came out that summer. I got reservations in Yosemite for a week in a tent. Anyway, she came out, and we traveled all over Yosemite, walked as much as we could. And the next year, we were going to do it again, and she came out and just stayed. And we got married a little over a year later. We got married in 90. So I know how long I've been married because it was 90. So we've been married now 32 years.
So, Marvin, I just wanted to thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, I can't tell you how much of a pleasure it is to me, because all my relatives kept saying, get this recorded. Maybe I can set them on this, or this will help them. And I'm so pleased. You know, I think for a farm kid in Ohio, I've had an interesting life.
Yeah, I have to say that is true.
So as a person, I would say that about myself anyway, but I think it's everything, the patents and the things I've been through, I think that it has some interesting points. So
yeah, it's really been a pleasure, and I wish you the best.
And the same to you. Thank you again. Bye.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed this three-part interview with Marvin. I know that I certainly did, and it'll be an experience that I'll cherish for the rest of my life. Now, I mentioned this before in the first segment, but if you'd like to send a message to Marvin, just send it my way and I'll forward it on to him. My email address is steve@uselessinformation.org. You can use the contact form on my website, or you can send a message through Facebook's Messenger. I will post the script for this episode on my website, that's uselessinformation.org, and I'll also include some photos of Marvin throughout his lifetime. He sent me a book that he wrote in 2006. It's titled Marvin's World, The Early Years, How I Became Me. And in it, he discusses his family history. He generously gave a copy to every family member that attended a reunion at the time. I have to tell you, there were points in this book where I burst out laughing. His sense of humor, it really came through. I should also mention, if anyone would like a copy of the summary that Marvin sent to me of his involvement with the Hollow Nickel case, just let me know and I can forward that on to you. Anyway, I'll bring this to a close, and I want to wish everyone who's about to celebrate the holiday a happy Thanksgiving. And as promised, I'll play Marvin's favorite track from his 1974 LP. It's the classic song, Fascination. Well, take care, everyone. Bye.
Would you like to relax or fall asleep while learning about history? If so, then try my podcast, Calm History. You'll learn all about famous explorers, inventions, civilizations, ancient wonders, and even the Titanic. Just search your podcast player for Calm History or go to calmhistory.com.